Hello, we're at the Royal Society of Medicine today for a debate on the subject of sex change operations and gender dysphoria. I'm with the freelance journalist Julie Bindle, who's about to go on stage here in front of an audience and an expert panel of critics, and Julie will try to argue a controversial case. Julie, what is the case you're going to put?
That sex change reassignment surgery is unnecessary, that we should be instead getting rid of gender roles, what's a real man, what's a real woman, so that people can live in their bodies comfortably without having to butcher healthy parts of their bodies.
Now, you're coming at this from a particular direction because you're generally known as a radical lesbian feminist, not a classic social conservative, aren't you? So when did you first come to a view on sex change operations?
When I was about 16 years old and I was able to leave home and meet feminists who were very inspiring, and then the world changed from black and white to colour.
Now, this is not an ordinary debate. We have a panel of critics. Are you going to cope? Are you a bit scared?
Terrified. I think that they're all eminent experts, they're all extremely good speakers, and to say that I'm a little more frightened than I normally am in these circumstances is not to exaggerate.
Okay. Well, let's go out there and see how you get on. Hello and welcome to the Royal Society of Medicine in London for Hecklers, our attempt to reinvigorate the ancient art of debate by deliberately making it an unlevel playing field. In Hecklers, we ask one person to set out a provocative case with four people against her, four hecklers who try and pull her argument apart. Today, it's the Guardian feature writer, Julie Bindle, and she argues the motion that sex change surgery is unnecessary mutilation. It's an emotive topic. Even the wrong use of different words can cause inadvertent offence. But we won't let that get in the way of our goal, which is to get to the root of the different opinions, not to resolve them, but to understand exactly what underlies sharp differences of view. Now, Julie gets about half an hour to present her anti-sex change case, but our panel of four hecklers will be consistently stopping her. Panel, could you introduce yourselves, and could you perhaps let us know whether you're speaking from personal experience on this subject?
Peter Tatchell, a sexual freedom and human rights campaigner. I am not a trans person.
Michelle Bridgman, I'm a psychotherapist and the project manager of the Gender Trust. The Gender Trust is a charity that supports individuals, couples, families and employers where gender identity is an issue. I began my life as a male, changed my gender role and subsequently had my sex reassigned.
I'm Stephen Whittle. I am the Professor of Equalities Law at Manchester Metropolitan University. I am a transsexual man. I was born female-bodied, and in 1975 I transitioned to living permanently as a man when I was 19.
I'm Kevin Wiley. I'm a consultant in sexual medicine in Sheffield. I'm clinical director of the Gender Dysphoria Service in Sheffield, and also currently chair the UK Standards of Care group looking at standards of care for people with gender dysphoria in the NHS.
Thank you, panel. Now, Julie's argument is divided into three chunks, and for each of the three pieces of the argument, she gets a few minutes uninterrupted. After the few minutes, the panel can start raising objections. I'll be ringing a bell at the start and end of each of the three chunks. Julie, you have to allow the hecklers to intervene and to answer the points. Panel, you have to heckle, otherwise Julie just gets to deliver a half-hour lecture, which is not really the purpose here today. At the end, we will take comments from this large and mixed audience. Are you all ready? Okay, Julie.
My proposition that sex change surgery should not be available and that the psychiatric diagnosis of transsexualism is questionable might lead some in the audience to jump to the conclusion that I'm some kind of ultra-conservative, the kind of person who would argue that homosexuality should be against the law. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. As a lifelong feminist and defender of human rights and the abused and the oppressed, I refute that claim. And it's because of, not in spite of, my commitment to equal rights and the acceptance of those who are just different, that I'm so vehemently opposed to the growing use of sex change surgery. Indeed, I suspect one day we will look back on the current era of sex change surgery with the same horror as we look back on the days of aversion therapy treatment for homosexuals. The parallels are striking. In the 1950s, a medical profession dominated by ultra-traditional men told us that homosexuality was a psychiatric condition, which they could cure. Those who didn't fit their stereotypes or their model of gender polarisation could be made to fit with the help of doctors. The treatment was traumatic and it didn't work. and the patients weren't ill, they were just different. The same goes for the so-called diagnosis of transsexualism, or gender identity dysphoria, as it's now known. A man who says he feels disengaged from the masculine norms isn't ill, he just doesn't fit society's expectations of what is a real man. The concept of transsexuality arises from the strong stereotyping of boys and girls, men and women. Would it exist if we lived in a world where the attitude to gender and sexual preference was relaxed, was live and let live? How could psychiatrists confirm a patient's self-diagnosis of transsexualism by asking if he played with dolls and makeup, if these behaviours were not forced upon children in the first place? Feminists and sections of the gay and lesbian liberation movement have, for the past four decades, lived outside of the gender roles prescribed to us by the traditionalists. The transgender industry and its spokespeople are the defenders of gender. In fact, they are running a gender protection racket. If you doubt me when I say those involved in the transgender industry are the ultra-conservatives, just take a visit to one of the shops which cater for transgender people, or look on the websites. One website aimed at transsexuals offers tips for men wishing to pass as women. This is what it says. Repeat constantly to yourself, raising your voice at least one octave. Am I going shopping today? Could you tell me the time, please? Can I try this blouse on, please? The clothes and behaviour patterns often rejected by modern women are seen as a key part of successful gender reassignment. One hormone cream even claims to enable men to feel the symptoms of premenstrual tension. Feminists who question the ethics of sex change surgery are the true progressives, and those offered butchery to correct psychological distress, the victims. Peter Tatchell.
Julie, you've made a comparison between aversion therapy to cure homosexuality and gender reassignment surgery. I don't think that's a valid comparison, because the assumption of aversion therapy was that there was something wrong with being gay or lesbian, and that people were often compelled against their wishes to undergo it. Whereas with gender reassignment surgery, no one is saying there's anything wrong with being male or female or transitioning from one to the other. It's simply that the individuals concerned don't feel that their body and their emotional and psychological feelings match together. So I think your argument on that point is fundamentally flawed.
I would argue that there are many who actually do feel railroaded into sex change surgery because they don't fit society's norms. By children as young as 12, for example, the case in Australia where a 12-year-old girl known as Alex, who was given hormone treatment to stop the onset of puberty. I think that there are many ways in which people who cannot live as gay or lesbian because of rampant homophobia are actually railroaded into feeling that they have to be the opposite sex rather than someone who can live happily as lesbian or gay. Stephen Whittle.
It's incredibly disingenuous of you to refer, for example, to the Alex case. When you read the decision and you saw the reports from that case, what is clear is that Alex himself was requesting treatment to postpone his puberty so he had time to think. And furthermore, it was quite clear that the only other alternative he would take was to commit suicide. And as the court said then, this is a case of giving this child choice rather than death.
Have we really thought about the way that we can offer talking therapies to people who identify as transgender, transsexual, children below the age of consent, who are actually given hormone treatment to stop the onset of puberty, can end up very seriously damaged health-wise, mental health and physical health? Michelle Bridgman.
Julie, firstly, as a fellow feminist, I'd like to say it's nice to be able to engage with you on this. But you're talking about people being railroaded into surgery. It's simply not true. And the other thing I want to say is that when you talk about gender stereotyping and people feeling that they should fit, the point you're missing is that people are very clear about the gender role that they're in. It just sometimes happens to be in the one that's opposite to the one they were born into. So it doesn't mean that they're necessarily confused or floating as some third gender. And there are people who change their gender role but don't necessarily change their bodies. You know, some people happily do that.
I'm one. I'm one who has changed my gender role without changing my body.
And I trust you're very happy, and I'm pleased that you have.
Can I just intervene and ask you, Julie, to explain your comment that you've changed your gender without changing your body?
Gender is a set of learnt behaviours, and for women this results in our oppression. So gender roles, which is learned and not innate, unlike sex, which is biological, actually benefits men. And the whole industry of transsexualism, I'm arguing, is one where we are taught to conform so that men maintain their gender role power over women. We can all play at gender, we can all wear our Doc Martin boots and frilly skirts together and crop our hair, etc. But what that actually doesn't do is explain that for women, gender roles, we don't play at them, we're oppressed by them. Peter Tatchell.
Julia, I've got considerable sympathy for your argument that the idea of traditional male and female roles is very oppressive. It does force people into often behaviour which is out of kilter with their own true desire. But that surely is what this whole debate about gender dysphoria and the whole issue of trans people is all about. It's about people saying that they themselves feel that their physical, biological gender doesn't match their emotional and psychological feelings. And it's about trying to, for them, to reintegrate the two. And your theory may be fine, but I just think you're losing track of the fundamental humanity of the people involved, so you're allowing theory to override the real-life human cases.
If I could just answer that, Peter, as a young child, as a 10, 11, 12-year-old who felt different and who wanted to become a lesbian, had I been offered hormone treatment and had I been offered for the onset of my puberty to be stopped, I would have taken it, grabbed it with both hands, because boys had more fun. It was horrific living as a lesbian or being accused of being a lesbian in the early 1970s. So I think we have to stand back and look at who we're actually making an assumption about and what their human rights really are. Is it really a human right to have a reversible hormone treatment which stops the onset of puberty? Kevin.
Patient choice and empowerment now is probably strongest than it ever has been. And now I think, you know, the UK standards of care are saying to doctors, to therapists, to everybody, hold back on this. You know, you don't need to push people into surgery, because many people went that way because that was the only way for them. So now we're actually giving people a choice and saying, well, you don't have to have surgery. You can have your hormones, you can have your talking therapies. Those are there to help you. But people still choose to go to the surgery. So what's wrong for them?
Well, why are so many patients reluctant to undergo psychological treatments, which have advanced enormously since the 1950s and 60s, when they were ruled out as treatment? What's the reason for that? And I would argue it's because it is now becoming more and more acceptable as a solution to a problem that could well actually be fixed by talking therapies, but we're not doing enough of it. Michelle Bridgman.
Yeah, I have a certain sympathy with this, Julie, because I think, as a therapist, I would argue that people should be encouraged to explore the actual meaning of what it means to be a male or a female, and I think that should be offered far more extensively than it is. However, the point that I think maybe you're overlooking is the fact that for a lot of people this is a very primal experience. It's something that many people arrive at from their earliest memory. So we're not talking about socialising or conditioning or stereotyping.
But there is evidence that people who are requesting sex change surgery are getting younger and younger.
I'd like us actually to move on to section two. I mean, I think we've covered the sort of general area rather well. The panel clearly doesn't accept the analogy between homosexuality, aversion therapy and gender reassignment. But the crucial argument is whether, on top of what you all agree with, the availability of talking therapies, the full works should be available and is sensibly taken up by some people. That I think we're not going to agree on. Let's move on to section two, which I know is also going to raise a lot of questions. So you've got 2-3 minutes again now, Julie. Time to go.
A key part of the credibility of the sex change industry is the veneer of scientific respectability with which it manages to cover itself. But that's all it is, a veneer. Beneath it, there is no credible scientific basis for categorising transsexualism as a medical disorder. And more worryingly, an astounding lack of research into the long-term outcomes for those who have surgery. How do doctors know when someone should be diagnosed transsexual? Is there some kind of hormone test they can do? Or some kind of brain scan with which will reveal a patient is trapped in the wrong body? No, they rely purely on self-diagnosis. But even if we accept the doctor's theory that this condition exists, how well does their supposed cure work? Here's the really shocking thing. They don't know. A review for the Guardian newspaper in 2005 of more than 100 international studies of post-operative transsexuals by the University of Birmingham found no robust scientific evidence that gender reassignment surgery is clinically effective. The results of many gender reassignment studies are unsound, because researchers lost track of more than half of the participants. For example, in a 5-year study of more than 700 post-operative transsexual people, almost 2/3 dropped out for unknown reasons. Of course, there has been no shortage over the years of articles about successful transitions. Those most vocal in the transsexual lobby are privileged individuals with lots of support from the community and fulfilling careers. But I suspect that these people are in the minority. Activists such as one of my opponents here tonight, Stephen Whittle, does not represent the majority, I would argue, of those who've had sex change surgery. Most don't have a voice. I mean it in the nicest possible way. There's a growing survivor network of those who feel that they should never have had the surgery in the first place. Some have even tried to have the surgery reversed. Many have told me that they feel under dreadful pressure from the community not to speak out and condemn surgery because it's akin to washing dirty linen in public. Stephen Whittle.
Well, first of all, I agree entirely with you that it's not an illness. But it is only doctors who can provide the solutions that people need or want. You talk about the Guardian study. Well, it actually missed the largest retrospective study ever undertaken. That was Friedman-Pfaffling's study, which was an analysis of over 40 long-term studies covering over 4,000 trans people. And it showed success rates in financial and social terms, not necessarily in surgical terms, of 86% to 88% for trans women and 96% to 98% for trans men. The requests for surgical reversal are tiny, absolutely tiny.
You talk about large studies, which actually have had their sample group somewhat questioned. So for one piece of science, obviously in every field, there's always something that can dispute that. But I also have to take issue with the fact that you say that doctors are the ones to actually diagnose this. I think we
I said doctors could provide the solutions that people needed or wanted.
You questioned the self-diagnosis, and for many of the people whose case studies I've read about and who've met and have talked to them, they tell me that it was reading something in a magazine,
seeing
something on the television.
I have never questioned self-diagnosis. I absolutely believe in self-diagnosis, because how can anybody else tell whether you feel like a man or a woman?
So what my question is, my argument is this: I don't know what this feeling is like to be a woman. What is it exactly?
It's who you are.
Kevin Wiley.
Well, I think it's a great shame that the medical profession seemed to have managed to get so many patients disengaged from them, you know, after the period of time that they've had the surgery. But, you know, we mustn't let that cloud our way of helping people from now on. The Shah study, which was done at the University of Sheffield a couple of years ago, was actually done to try and work out whether or not it was a worthwhile, effective treatment. And to be fair, you know, they came out with a very sort of ambiguous statement, which was not entirely helpful for people who wanted the surgery. They looked at 172 studies, and I think they found it was 78 were published that sort of helped try one way or the other.
Kevin, sorry, this is a very important point. Are you telling me that there is no clear medical consensus on whether the full surgery leaves patients satisfied with their new condition?
Well, the problem is the way that the outcome was measured in most of these different studies. And of course, you know, surgical acumen is quite a different thing from a patient's quality of life or how a patient feels that their transition and their surgery has helped them.
Is there any other such significant medical procedure over which there is so little evidence of success, failure, patient regret or patient satisfaction?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to look at other analogies, you know, because, I mean, you can offer somebody who's got a surgical, an inoperable cancer, for example, you may offer them surgery. They may be railroaded into having it. I mean, it might sound quite different here, but, you know, most people would feel that they've been given the chance and they should feel better for it, but not everybody does. And
isn't it the case, though, Kevin, that many primary care trusts are now limiting or withdrawing funding for this type of surgery? Yes, because of NHS debts on the one hand, but also because the NHS is moving towards providing only evidence-based treatments.
Yes, and that's where I think that we together with trans people and the medical profession have to work properly together and actually say this is not just a 12-month, 24-month process, it's a 5-year process, and will you engage and work with us?
Michelle Bridgman.
taking your point about diagnosis, I mean, it's something that clearly has to be initially self-diagnosed, but to put out the argument that people just fast-track themselves through is really quite irresponsible. I mean, it's always possible these days for people to buy surgery, and that's clear. But nobody who goes through a proper treatment channel is fast-tracked. I don't believe that ever happens.
We know that's not true, Michelle, because we've just actually had the case of Russell Reed go through the GMC, where it was found that he did, in fact, fast-track people.
It didn't find that, actually. Yeah. What it found out was he did not take enough time to get on board all the issues. They weren't fast-tracked.
But isn't that fast-tracking, though, Stephen?
No, it isn't. Fast-tracking is saying to people, you can have surgery now within 3 months. He didn't. It was a year later before he suggested.
It's seriously worrying that you can actually agree with a self-diagnosis to send someone forward for irreversible hormones within the hour.
No one agrees with a self-diagnosis.
There are cases who will speak out publicly.
Julie,
and say
if I can
that
continue the point, you will find people, of course you will, but if you talk to the vast majority, that simply doesn't happen.
Let's just establish, because I do want to clarify these points, and we don't want to just let them lie. You agree that there are some patients, Julie, who are presumably very satisfied with the treatment they get. And Michelle, you will agree that there are some
who are
given bad treatment
but we
or
have
accelerated.
It's in proportion. It's very small in comparison
okay.
to the
Do
open
Do you agree with that, Julie, that it's a small
are.
Proportion? Do
we
you
can't know how small those cases are. It's exactly like any people who've been through a really bad experience where there isn't an actual movement to support them, where they feel on their own, isolated, where they actually don't have a voice. And I think that's what's happened in this issue. Peter Tatchell.
I'm sure you're right to say that there are some people who've had gender reassignment surgery who are unhappy with the result, just as there is with every medical procedure. But that does not invalidate the fundamental point that people who feel in this situation should have their choice and their right to self-determination respected. And I don't hear you listening. I hear you listening to a point, but making too many generalisations and putting ideology before the human
Peter,
being.
Peter, I think that the fact... Peter, the fact that this diagnosis was invented in the 1950s, I think really we should stand back and look at what was happening in the 1950s for women, for lesbians, for gay men, and what the expectations were of those psychiatrists when they decided to apply a surgical solution to what was a psychological issue for those patients.
Julie, I just want to clarify one other point. If I told you, and we agreed, because we did do all the studies, that it was, say, a two-thirds success rate in terms of patient satisfaction, would you say then you're wrong and recant your argument? Is this an argument over the fact, over how many patients regret?
No, it's a fundamental argument against the diagnosis itself.
Okay.
And
so
it's also an argument...
Well, that wouldn't be enough to change the argument. Let me just remind you that you're listening to Hecklers on Radio 4 with me, Evan Davis. We're at the Royal Society of Medicine, where Julie Bindle is defending her argument that sex change operations are unnecessary mutilation. Julie, you now go on to your third section, 2 minutes uninterrupted.
In their own eyes, anorexics are horribly overweight. Demands from their families and doctors that they gain weight can lead to depression and suicide. If gender dysphoria is successfully treated by removing unwanted organs, shouldn't anorexics be given radical liposuction? The diagnosis of transsexualism has opened the door to the invention of yet another condition, which is every bit as worrying, body dysmorphic disorder, where sufferers can experience a desperate urge to rid themselves of a limb or limbs. The leading psychiatrist known for referring transsexual patients for surgery said in an interview, when justifying referring two men to have healthy leg amputations, "When I first heard of people wanting amputations, it seemed bizarre in the extreme. But then I thought, I see transsexuals and they want healthy body parts removed in order to adjust to their idealised body image. And so I think that was the connection for me," he said. In my final section of this debate, I'm going to argue that the politics of the transsexual movement has led us not just into murky medical territory, but into legal absurdity too. Recent changes in the law means that we are now in the crazy situation where someone only has to say they're a woman to be legally accepted as a woman, and vice versa. It is now possible for a transsexual woman to get a job as a counsellor in a rape crisis centre, even if such a role is, for understandable reasons, reserved for born women only. Such laws were enacted because of a fundamental confusion between sex and gender. Your sex is something you are born into. It is a biological fact. Gender, on the other hand, is simply a social construct. When the law and the medical profession are now claiming, without any scientific evidence, is that gender is a biological fact too, then I seriously worry. As a feminist, I believe that women aren't genetically pre-programmed to wear dresses, walk in high heels, and favour pastel colours. If we believed that, then feminism would never have got off the ground. I accept that many of my opponents in the medical profession are well-meaning, but they are also naive. They may think they're being terribly liberal and trying to help people, but their ideas are dangerously anachronistic, unscientific, and causing misery to many. Stephen Whistle.
The thing is, you can't just say nowadays that you are a woman and be a woman. There may be no surgical precondition for a new birth certificate, but that requirement or that no need for that requirement is in fact only available if there is good reason, for example health issues which might prevent surgery, or the long waiting lists of the National Health Service. The fact is, people have to permanently live in their new gender for 2 years, right at the start of treatment, when they look very strange. This is a really difficult requirement. In comparisons with anorexics or people have their legs chopped off, it's actually ridiculous. The fact is that anorexics can't cope with their life. Trans people have to be able to cope with their life in order to just go through permanently living for 2 years as a woman or a man without any surgery.
But you have used the argument though, Stephen, that if a young person, if a person who believes to be transsexual is threatening suicide, then what we do is we offer that treatment, the surgical solution.
Well,
where we would not
do we let them kill themselves?
Then
we don't offer surgery. Nobody who is suicidal is ever going to be offered gender reassignment surgery.
Are there not websites which actually tell people what to say to a psychiatrist at the first visit so that the boxes are ticked and the psychiatrist is happy that that person is transgendered? Kevin Wiley.
Surely that's a very naive understanding of our understanding of how our patients approach it.
I've seen the websites, Kevin. I've read them.
The websites are there, but when I see my patients, I don't ask them those kind of things to begin with because I know what they're going to come and say, so you know, I don't want to know all that. But part of the issue here is having to be able to trust our patients, having to somehow empathise with something that we have no understanding of other than through the words and the world of our patients' experiences. I agree with you that people with body dysmorphia should not have surgery unnecessarily. You know,
Can you explain why we shouldn't actually remove a healthy leg, a limb, if someone is totally convinced that that leg does not belong to their body and that is not who they are in their brain as a person?
Because usually people with that degree of dysmorphophobia are delusional and need some other work.
Well, the psychiatrist who actually referred the two men to have their legs removed said they absolutely had no psychiatric problems whatsoever.
But that doesn't mean that he should then have agreed for it to happen. I mean, I don't think most doctors, psychiatrists, physicians in this country would go along with that in any way.
Stephen Whittle.
Transsexualism is something completely different from the idea of wanting to have your leg cut off. It's naive to have this singular view of what happens, which is based at extreme ends. I could say, oh look, there are people selling kidneys so people can have kidney transplants, but that's the extreme end. The vast majority of kidney transplants, like the vast majority of gender reassignment sleep treatments, are actually provided over a long period of time after a lot of consideration, ensuring quality, etc.
I'm not sure that that's the case at all. From hearing people who are actually just starting to come out now and talk about the shoddy treatment that they had.
I had terribly shoddy treatment.
Peter Tatchell.
Even if we take your view that these people are fundamentally misguided, that they've fallen into this trap of traditional male and female roles, even if we take that view, wouldn't a more humane response be to argue for better education in schools to challenge male and female stereotypes so people feel more comfortable about being who they are?
Absolutely, and that's as a feminist what I think should happen, what I'm trying to do. But I think you're actually suggesting something different. What you're saying is that we open people's minds up to the fact that there's men, there's women, born men, women, and then there are transgendered people. But I actually want to live in a world where there are no gender definitions. Why then would we need surgery to make us one thing or the other? This isn't an attack on individual or collective transsexuals. This is an attack on the industry.
That's the way they see
it. Well, of course it is, because anyone who ever even questions the notion of the diagnosis of transgenderism is attacked as if we are literally saying, bring back hanging. And there is no room ever to speak about it.
Well, Julie,
there's vitriol, and I'm not talking about this panel, I'm not talking about my colleagues here, but there's vitriol in the extreme if you even question it.
But Julie, that's what you are saying, because you say you want to ban gender
you
reassignment
You use the term
surgery.
Ban, Peter. I don't use the term ban.
Motion
what I would
today
suggest is that the industry is questioned.
Can I just point out, there's a really good example of gender role here. I can't get a word in edgeways with three men.
Where I
have a problem with this, Julie, is that you're just failing all the time to listen to what people are saying. We all accept that there may be faults, so let's agree that we all believe that to be the case. The other thing is, I personally take offence to the view that a transsexual woman, which I am, couldn't work as a therapist with other women in something like a rape crisis, because I think it's personally offensive. And what you're doing is you're perpetuating these stereotypes you're so hard on by suggesting that it's going to be an issue.
If I can come back on that. Okay. The reality, I want to live in a world without gender. The reality is that as women we are oppressed, and one of the ways that we're oppressed is from sexual violence from, in the main, men. And I think that our life experience of growing up being told that we're sex objects and we're there to be used, if I'll just finish, Michelle, that gives us a particular necessity to sometimes organise in a women-only way where men are not involved in this. Now, we're talking about transsexual women, I understand your point, but it should be up to a woman who has been raped, for example, by a man, to be counselled by women who have the life experience of being oppressed, grown up as a girl, being oppressed by men.
I want us to get back to this point. Is it entirely a social construct,
gender,
or is it not? You don't think it is?
Not.
Okay, thank you. Can I just hear from the rest of the panel, including Kevin, who is more medically qualified, his view on whether the condition of gender is social conditioning or whether it's biological fact.
I do actually think it's a pretty fluid condition which makes ourselves up.
You don't, Kevin, don't believe the studies that show brains of women and men are different, and that transgender
yes,
people
of course,
are different.
There are some differences, but that doesn't mean that the whole concept of gender itself and how we feel or experience our gender necessarily has to be entirely the consequences of some biological or hormonal process. That may contribute towards it, but I mean, if we think that it's that simplistic, then I think we're deluding ourselves.
So just to be clear, Michelle, can you just answer whether you think it's a construct or whether it's conditioning?
No, I'm saying it's not conditioning. For me, it was a primary experience.
I just want to hear Peter Tatchell's view on whether it's social construct, gender or not.
If we look at all different societies around the world, in all different moments in history, we find that trans people have existed. And, you know, that cannot just be something that is purely a social construct. There must be an element of biology. And even if it was a social construct, so what? People come before ideology.
I think we've heard that there's some disagreement over that, but essentially there is. It's an area of a rather mute point. Julie, can you sum up for us, draw this together, and then that's the end of your half hour, Julie, and we'll get some points from the audience.
In the late 19th century, sexologists said that homosexuals were biological mistakes who naturally contained characteristics of one sex within the body of another. Havelock Ellis's case study of sexual inversion, for example, showed men who liked women's clothes as children and considered themselves to have women's brains in men's bodies. This theory was rejected by feminists and gay liberationists in the 1970s. But these 19th century arguments and understandings about female brains in male bodies and vice versa are alive and well in the present medical practice around transsexualism. In a world where equality between men and women was a total reality, transsexualism would not exist. The diagnosis of gender dysphoria needs to be questioned and challenged. 2/3 of young people diagnosed as such will become lesbian or gay in later life and no longer have the desire for surgery or hormones. The transsexual lobby and its supporters in the medical and legal profession is detrimental to women and gay liberation.
Julie Mendel, thank you very much. We'll take some comments from the audience. The audience have got some strong views as well, I think. We'll go here first.
Ros Caveney, writer and activist. I do find Julie Bindle's claims of compassion for the misdiagnosed a little disingenuous, inasmuch as it has been precisely those trans women and trans men who challenge gender stereotypes in their post-surgical lives who have been consistently subjected to vilification and discrimination by feminists, not necessarily by Julie Bindle herself, but by feminists with whom she's broadly in agreement. We've seen people's jobs threatened. We've seen people excluded from social venues. Now, if we were talking about compassion, you might disagree with people's choices, but you surely wouldn't try and make their lives more difficult.
Is that an experience that you've had?
Oh, yes.
exclusion by feminist circles because...
A friend of mine was fired from Gay News, where she worked as a photographer, because a number of feminist venues refused to appear in the listing section if Gay News had a transsexual employee.
Other points, any towards the back? Can we take the lady over there?
Yeah. My name is Claudia McLean. I am the person who was recommended for surgery after 45 minutes. That happened in 1986, and I have lived a long time to regret it. I have lived a life apart, honestly, since this had happened. And I think that that woman over there, called Julie Bindle, is a valuable, wonderful voice in the wilderness. I don't agree with everything that she says, but I am delighted that I made her acquaintance and have taken part in trying to tighten up that kind of monetary gain for psychiatry and surgery. Because what happened to me was actually, in my view, about money. At no time did I say to that psychiatrist, I feel like a woman. How would I know what a woman feels like? How would I know that? I've got to say something else very painfully in this public forum. That is to say that the surgery didn't work and I'm incapable of sex. For everyone here who is trans and happy, I say brava. God bless you all. And I'm glad that that's how it is for you. Alas, it was not for me.
Very much appreciate you sharing that with us. Thank you very much. We'll move on to another question. Take the one over here.
My name is Hilary Henry. I underwent gender reassignment surgery in 1979. And as such, I must have been among the first few to be operated under the National Health Service. Now, I would say that if I was mutilated during that surgery, don't you think I would have noticed by now? I totally agree with Ms. Bindle that there is a need for long-term surveillance research. But the thing is, we're here. If they want to do research on us, I for one would come forward gladly. In fact, I and a friend, although we were willing to maintain our contact with the hospital, the National Health Service couldn't afford to allow us to continue, even though we were willing.
So the follow-up didn't happen because it was just kind of, it cost too much to keep track of everybody and to keep asking them how they're getting on, and so
because we were taking up appointments. I think that was the point.
What's your general experience of other people in your cohort? Generally satisfied? All satisfied? Mostly dissatisfied?
I would say overwhelmingly satisfied.
I'm going to move on to the gentleman over there. Yep.
My name is John Ireland, and I'm an orthopaedic surgeon. And 10 years ago, had I been at this discussion, I would have been in favour of Julie Bindle's proposition. But I happen to know a very distinguished orthopaedic surgeon whose sex change was somewhat in the news, and who has had what I would say was a complete personality change and is so much happier that my view has changed completely.
But being a medical man, you don't normally go on this sort of anecdotal evidence, do you? You normally need more than the sample of one on any of the treatments you normally dish out in your own area.
Quite so. But nevertheless, when somebody is known to you quite well, it does affect your view. And my question to Julie is, have you known anybody really well, personally, who has been through this, which has in any way changed your view or tried to change your view?
Very quickly, Julie, just answer perhaps that one point, and then I'm going to go to a last question.
I'm still in touch with someone who contacted me after an article I wrote 4 years ago, who is a transgender woman who was very happy for the first year, and she's not happy anymore. But when she was happy for the first year, I was very happy for her.
Okay, that's an answer to the question. We'll take one last comment here.
Yes, I started life as a male. Now I am exceedingly happy as Sarah, the sort of woman that you as a radical feminist would probably despise, sitting here in my pastel cardi and top and my high heels. But I think I'm the happy one, and maybe you're the one who's got problems with your sex. But what I would like to say is that my only regret is, in fact, that I never had the courage or perhaps the desperation to do it earlier.
Interesting. Julie, I'm going to give you the last word. Ultimately, gender does exist in our society, even though you might want to get rid of it. And there are a lot of people who clearly are happier reassigning themselves from the one they were given as a child. What do you say to those people? They shouldn't be reassigned? You know, gender's with us, and it's looks like it's got a few more years in it, doesn't it?
Well, I have neither the right nor the power to tell anyone about their own personal choices, whether or not they seek surgery through the NHS or privately, or hormones in the same way. My arguments with the industry, my arguments with the diagnosis, and in a sense, my argument is not really that. It's a question. It's saying, why is it that no one, we're all good liberals here, and yet we go along with a diagnosis that to me has only ever been questioned by homophobes, transphobes, the evangelical Christian right. That means a voice is missing. And what transsexualism does is it puts people in very distinct gender roles, which I and other feminists are trying to do away with. So as I say, it's not about the individual's happiness, dissatisfaction or otherwise. It's with the diagnosis, and it's with the industry. And it's merely to say that, yes, I think I am a bit of a voice in the wilderness. It's really rare that anyone questions this, and that's all I'm trying to do tonight, to question it.
Thank you. It just remains for me to say thank you to our panel, Dr. Kevin Wiley of the Gender Dysphoria Service in Sheffield, Professor Stephen Whittle of Press for Change, the Transgender Lobby Group, Michelle Bridgman, psychotherapist representing the Gender Trust, and Peter Tatchell, and above all to Julie Bindle for making her argument. Next week we're at the Galleries of Justice in Nottingham, where the Liberal Democrat MP Mark Oughton will be arguing that we should abolish all prisons. Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.
Hecklers is chaired by Evan Davis and produced by Innes Bowen.